not even know for sure the name with which we should address you. We remember that the ancient Hebrews would not even dare to say your name. Yet somehow, through Jesus our brother, we dare to say the name Abba and hope that we know and believe that this is the right name. We thank you for our week together. We thank you for the gift that we are and can be to each other. And we confess before you that we, like Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, and all the Christians who have thought about it down through the ages, do not really know how to think and speak about the resurrection, that hope for new life, which nevertheless stands at the mysterious center of our faith and our life. Again, we thank you for the privilege of being together. Again, we thank you for the ancient, rich, almost fathomless treasure of the word that has been passed on to us. Again, we thank you for this hour, this moment. Amen. Okay, now we're going to just chug away at the resurrection texts and do an awful lot of reading down here at the end of Matthew's Gospel. And I thought it would be all right to start this morning with a sandwich. Two slices of apologetic sandwiched around the Easter text, and then just look, so by way of warm up, at some of the implications when you play the mirror game with Luke, for instance, of this two slices of the apologetic sandwich around Matthew's Easter text. You know what I'm talking about, and I didn't quite get a chance to or take the time to figure out whether these are directly preached on. Maybe you could take some time, but the sandwich, of course, is two sections that are totally unique to Matthew in the synopsis, paragraph 351. The guard at the tomb, Matthew 27, 62 to 66, and then the other half of the sandwich, the other slice of bread, 354, the report of the guard, Matthew 28, 11 to 15. So let's just read that one, those reflectively, asking ourselves the questions. You can ask yourself as many questions as you want, but my suggestion is the first question we ask. Why did Matthew, in his redaction, in his retelling the story, the mysterious, awesome story of the resurrection, whatever the resurrection is, why did he feel he had to include these two paragraphs for the people in Antioch? The Christian community, probably made up of many Jews, probably made up of some Gentiles, probably made up of people semi-affluent. Why did he think he had to tell these two stories? You look like you're about to read, so why don't you there with his book out, his mouth half open. So
yeah.
we start with Matthew 27, 62 to 66. And then we're going to have some material after that. And then Matthew closes off that motif at 28, 11 to 15. So if you read just the sandwich,
sure.
And we'll look at it.
I'll read
and go slowly because I'm following along in the Greek.
next day, the one after preparation day, the chief priests and the Pharisees went to Pilate. Am I reading the right place? Yes. Mm-hmm. Sir, they said, we remember that while he was still alive, that deceiver said, after 3 days I will rise again.
Now here we have the prediction of the passion and the resurrection, which is a set piece in Matthew, Mark and Matthew, being repeated or echoed in the mouths of the adversaries, right? Okay?
So give the order for the tomb to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise, his disciples may come and steal the body and tell the people that he has been raised from the dead. This last deception will be worse than the first. Take a guard, Pilate answered. Go, make the tomb as secure as you know how. So they went and made the tomb secure by putting a seal on the stone and posting the guard.
Now, from a literary point of view, this is upping the dramatic ante, because that seal is going to be broken. From an apologetic point of view, we're anticipating the enemy's charge, and then also from the point of view of the fulfillment of prophecy, even the enemies know that Jesus promised to do this. That's at least, this is what's happening there. It doesn't yet tell why Matthew feels he has to repeat this for the people in Antioch in 85. Okay, the next one. 28:11-15.
While the women were on their way, some of the guards went into the city and reported to the chief priests everything that had happened. When the chief priests had met with the elders and devised a plan, they gave the soldiers a large sum of money, telling them, you are to say, his disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep. If this report gets to the governor, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble. So the soldiers took the money and did as they were instructed. And this story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this very day.
Okay. I mean, that last one is kind of the answer, right? Apparently, then, this is one of the texts that Christopher Stendhal would pick up to justify his theory that the book is an apologetic, sort of a textbook for Christian apologists in a sort of no-holds-barred struggle with the synagogue down the street, who certainly would be one of the people keeping this rumor alive. So the framework of Matthew's story of the resurrection is this charge that it's no real resurrection, folks. The body, it was just stolen by his disciples. Now, I don't know, have we answered the question I asked? Why would Matthew tell this to the people in Antioch? Any additional ideas of why? You know, you always have to pay special attention when either Matthew or Luke is flying solo, is doing it, you know, neither picking up the pink, which is Mark, or the blue, which is Q, and you know that scholars nowadays are dating Q about 50. So Q is in their well-reasoned argumentation, even earlier than our redaction of Mark. So when you get stuff that in Luke's case is yellow, or in Matthew's case, in this chart, is white, then you pay special attention. I mean, these scrolls weren't so big that you just wrote down something that was kind of there in your notes, because you necessarily wouldn't get lost. You put stuff in there for a reason. Well, if that has been sufficiently answered, is there anybody with more ideas than we've sort of extracted now from this stuff on why it was used, what the significant literary, theological, and apologetic significance of this material is? If you don't have any more ideas, then I'm going to go to the next thing on comparing what Luke does with what Matthew does with some of the problems here. Because one of the issues in the resurrection, of course, is what? If Jesus came back from the dead, comma, finish the sentence.
Where is he?
If Jesus came back from the dead, where is he? That's one of the problems for them. You know, that one of the things that always strikes me is how different our problems are from theirs, in one sense. I don't know whether I've said this week. If I haven't, it's really strange because I say it almost every time I open my mouth about the New Testament stuff. For the earliest witnesses, the issue was, yes, we know Jesus of Nazareth because we've seen him, we've touched him. In what sense, their big problem was, in what sense is this Jesus of Nazareth really more than a mere man? And there you have all these titles. What does Son of Man mean? What does the human being mean? You have this whole, but that's their question. In what sense is this human being divine? Ours is the opposite. At least mine is, and I suspect you're like me. I never remember a time when I was not programmed by my parents to pray to Jesus as God. My mother tells a story about when I was very little and had just discovered strawberries and got a very bad stomach ache that night. But as I went to sleep and said my prayers, as my folks, of course, taught me to do, I said, "And oh, thank you, Jesus, for strawberries." So before I could think about anything but strawberries, I was praying to Jesus as God. That was my name for God. Now, the rest of my life, up now into my early 60s, have been a struggle to say just the opposite of the early Christian. In what sense human? In what sense human? And give or take a little bit, the problem here is somewhat analogous. These people were saying, okay, he was a real person who really died, and then comes in, but as he promised, he came back from the dead. And then you have a whole series of questions. Where's the body? If he came back from the dead, what was that coming back from the dead like? And where is he now? You were going to say something.
it just seems terribly strange to me that Matthew makes no reference to, you know, those post-resurrection appearances. That's strange from me.
You got your finger right on it. How that's, you know, one of the great challenges of exegesis is how do you interpret silences? Mm-hmm. How do you interpret what isn't said? How do you interpret what it, let's hold that one and then just go and put the mirror up to Luke, just for the fun of it, as we start out, to see how Luke deals with the questions. Okay, if resurrected, what was it like? And then, if Jesus came back from the dead, where's the body? Luke has his own answers to this question. Now, let's just hold the mirror up to Luke, not for the sake of studying Luke right now, but for the sake of dramatizing how Matthew deals with the problem differently. One of my favorite pieces in all Scripture, Luke 24, 36 to 43. Remember I said that Kaiserman said we should start understanding the New Testament by going through the strangest doors we can find. Well, this is one of the strange doors. Luke 24, 36 to 43. And somebody read it once.
As they were saying this, Jesus himself stood among them.
This is in the post-resurrection appearances that you pointed out Matthew doesn't touch on.
But they were startled and frightened and supposed that they saw a spirit.
And said, what?
And suppose they saw a spirit.
Okay, is this a ghost? Mm-hmm. What's going on here? They were scared. So in Luke's telling of it, the post resurrection Jesus was a scary phenomenon, okay?
And he said to them, why are you troubled, and why do you question, or why do questions rise in your hearts? See my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. Handle me and see, for a spirit is not flesh and bones, as you see that I have.
So just, you know, picking up to what we were doing last night, hold me, touch me, okay?
And while they still disbelieved for joy and wondered, he said to them, have you anything here to eat? And they gave him a piece of broiled fish, and he took it.
Salmon probably left over from last
Well, there was carcass there. And then he said to them, 43
Yeah, keep reading. I want, there's a part I have to get to for my own joy.
Them, these are my words which I spoke to you while I was still with you.
No. I haven't seen the fish go down yet. That's what I want.
And he gave them a piece of broiled fish, and he took it and ate it before them.
Okay, he took it and ate it before them. Spirits don't eat fish. I mentioned just a little while ago my childhood faith. I can still remember hearing this text read in church, and I was so vivid that I can still see it, thinking, oh my goodness, how wonderful. Here he eats it, and they can see it go down. You know, I figured he was that much of a goat anyway. But here is this piece of fish. I call it the most important piece of fish in the gospel tradition. What is Luke saying? Now, that's an important question. What is Luke saying? This isn't just casual shaking out of your sleeve. What's Luke saying? There's an echo here, if you watch carefully, between Luke's talking about the resurrection and Luke's talking way back here at the beginning about the baptism. There is, if you'll notice, if you read the baptism text very carefully, the dove that comes down in Luke's account, and only in Luke's account, it comes down somatikos eide. Somatikos with the omega sigma is an adverb. In bodily form, with a certain physicality. So, even at the in the way Luke tells the baptism of Jesus, he wants it to be to tell it as physically as possible, to avoid the criticism of illusion. And here again, with that famous piece of fish, he's saying, "Listen, folks, it ain't ethereal; it's real; it's physical." But you got the guy eating fish. What you're going to do with him? Read Luke 24, 50 to 53, and we'll take the time. Acts 1, 6 to 11. What are you going to do with him? You get him off stage with the
ascension.
And Luke has got two, take your pick, forms of the ascension. And how many other people have the ascension? Does Mark have an ascension? Does John? Well, there's this funny business where he says, do not touch me, I have not yet ascended to the Father. And then they can touch him after he breathes on them. So there's kind of an offstage ascension in John, some people say. But if whatever it is, it's not front and center. But of course, that's an interesting problem in John, because John has a lot of good stuff off stage. You know, you have no baptism account in John. You just have the memory of it. And you don't really have a words of institution in John. That's off stage or presupposed. And you don't have an ascension in John. So that's kind of a whole fascinating another dimension. But let's read the two ascension. So the ascension, all I'm saying, is a Lucan characteristic. It's the way Luke deals with this, one of the ways Luke deals with the multi-dimensioned mystery of the resurrection. Let's just read those two. Who's got it? Got it there?
Could we come back to this fish thing?
Stay with the fish right now.
Okay, well, I just wondered if there was anything significant about the broiled fish other than the fact that what they were eating that evening or that day. Is there any significance to it being fish rather than a piece of lamb or...
I don't know. I mean, certainly. You see, that's coming back to the Kaiserman insight. How many symbols and sort of open doors to reflection were these writers putting into their material? I think a lot more than we would. You're saying the fish was the earth symbol of the early Christian or something like that.
Well, I just wondered if that...
I don't know. And it's the kind of question, the only honest answer is I don't know. But I guess after you say that first, an honest and sort of defensible answer, I don't know, then you could say, but it might be, you know, I don't know. Okay, will you read the first?
I haven't got my reading glasses today.
What have I to read?
I would like you to read the first version of Luke's first version of the Ascension.
Okay. Then he led them out as far as Bethany, and lifting up his hands, he blessed them. While he blessed them, he parted from them. And they returned to Jerusalem with great joy and were continually in the temple blessing God.
Now he led them out of the city here, didn't he? Isn't that... Let's just watch that little detail later when we come back to Matthew. Now, did you read through 53?
Yeah. And they were continually in the temple blessing God.
Now, wait, did the ascension take place yet?
This version carried up into heaven.
Yeah, we'll go through the ascension. Did you read it?
Oh, sorry, that's the end of my...
Yeah, well, I'm...
verse 51.
51, all right. While he blessed them, he parted from them. And they returned to Jerusalem. Yeah. Am I missing something?
Yeah, oh, but no, it was carried up into heaven in this one.
Yeah.
Yeah, my verse is that he was taken up into heaven.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Is that missing?
Other ancient
it's a footnote for me.
Yeah.
Well, he's got one of the ancient authorities that omit. Let's get one of the ancient authorities that doesn't omit for the sake of my peace of mind.
There we are.
Let's see.
How did you get a different Bible?
She's got a girl's Bible, you've got a boy's Bible.
When he blessed them, he parted from them and was carried up into heaven.
Okay. Huh. And was carried up into heaven. Now, we aren't going to get into the manuscript fight. Let's go to Acts, because I just want to look at the fact of the ascension. But I think it's very important. I'm so glad we did this. It's very important to notice that there is a dust-up in the manuscript tradition. If there's a dust-up in the manuscript tradition, you've got something that even the early scribes weren't quite sure how we're going to handle this baby. And maybe the folks that left out the last verse were good Orthodox scribes whose mother had read them from Matthew when they were little. And they weren't quite sure that Luke was right with this up into the heavens business.
Where does the phrase dust up come from? I've never heard that before. Is that your phrase or is that a scholarly phrase?
Well, one thing for sure, it's not a scholarly phrase. and then it's not my phrase either. It's just, it's a little battle.
Yeah.
Okay. It's a dust up.
Okay.
Or like we touch up photos now?
And a touch up, gloss.
No, it's a battle. I'm sorry. It's a battle in the manuscript tradition. I mean, for instance, you get into the... I'm thinking about this now because I'm going to be teaching it when I get back. You get into the prologue of John, and then you look at the apparatus down below with the different readings of the manuscript, and you see how high the theological stakes were, because there's even deep theological differences in the way you punctuate some of those things. And without him was not anything made that was made, goes on, or that all that was made came through him. There's just a lot of different ways that the scribes copied depending on their theological view. And so what I call a dust-up is a little battle down in the apparatus down here.
The dust is flying because they're fighting.
Exactly, exactly. Well, thank you for, because I didn't realize I wasn't being clear at that point. Everybody knew what a dust-up was. Okay, now read the other version. We're spending more time on this than we should, because this is only the mirror to what's going on in Matthew. But it's also instructive, I think, just to see how these people... How Luke, whom I'm sure wrote, there was one person, probably not Luke, according to tradition, that put together these two volumes. I'm sure that one person or one mindset put together these two volumes. But there are two different versions, really, of the Ascension. Read Acts 1, 6 to 11.
So when they had come together, they asked him, Lord, will you at this time restore the kingdom of Israel?
Now, but in the paragraph before that, he had been with them for 40 days. Remember that? And there's an interesting Greek word that can mean, and there's a dust up in the apparatus there in the manuscript tradition, eating salt with them, fellowshipping with them. So 40 days he was with them. This is sort of an extension of the reality of the piece of fish. And then, now Luke has his early group saying, aha, is the kingdom finally coming? That's where you stop. Okay, keep going.
He said to them, it is not for you to know times or seasons which the Father has fixed by his own authority. But you shall receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you, and you shall be my witnesses in Jerusalem, and in all Judea and Samaria, and to the end of the earth.
Okay, now will that have a familiar ring when we get to what I insist is also part of the resurrection account in Matthew, the Great Commission?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, go ahead.
And when he had said this, as they were looking on, he was lifted up, and a cloud took him out of their sight.
Now, this is a little different. A cloud took him out of their sight. Okay?
And while they were gazing into heaven as he went, behold, two men stood by them in white robes and said, Men of Galilee, why do you stand looking into heaven? This Jesus who was taken up from you into heaven will come in the same way as you saw him go into heaven.
Okay, now there's an elaboration. This is one of the explicit, one of the few explicit promises of what we call the parousia, the return, in the gospel tradition. I don't think you do not have either an ascension or a promise of the parousia, the reappearance, in Matthew, do you? I'm getting into the mirror business. What? You've got this stuff in Luke. A lot of it isn't in Matthew. A lot of the stuff in Luke, which reflects, I'm not saying that Matthew used Luke, but they both used the oral tradition. A lot of the stuff that's sort of there in one form in Luke is there in another form in Matthew. So now let's look at the whole resurrection text. And I affirm, as I did in this little survey last night, that ultimately you've got to do the whole chapter 28 together.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
In Acts, maybe I missed this, and you were saying in Acts, he apparently ascended from the Mount of Olives. At the end of Luke, is that the same place? It says.
Well, let's look back, and it doesn't say, does it?
Say that a mount.
But now in Acts, it is a mount, right?
In Acts, it's a mount. Well.
And tells them not to leave Jerusalem.
In Luke, you go out, and you assume it's on a mountain, right?
All right.
Bethany.
It's Bethany.
Bethany.
wherever Bethany is.
Well, Bethany is not necessarily, well, it's the Mount of Olives is the sacred mount in Matthew.
In Acts, it's after they've seen him go up, but it says, then they returned to Jerusalem from the hill called the Mount of Olives.
Yeah,
so you're led to believe that that's what it is.
Yeah, and then, and so you, by extension, you pull that back to Luke, but it doesn't necessarily say a mountain. But the mountain is important because in Matthew you have it.
Right.
Okay. Okay, let's just, what I was starting to say was that the two texts, the Easter text assigned is 28, 1 to 10, and then there's this sandwich in there that we've read, 11 to 15, and that I can think can be left out, but you cannot, I think, preach on 28, 1 to 10 without also preaching on 28, 16 to 20. And that text, 28, 16 to 20, the Great Commission, is assigned for Holy Trinity Sunday down June 10th, the first Sunday after Pentecost. And I just think that you have to have, you know, the contextual considerations of preaching would say you have to have both of those together on both days. And you'll emphasize one thing on Easter and the same thing, but more stuff on the first Sunday of Pentecost. So let's then begin to by reading the Easter text assigned 28, 1 to 10. Actually, in the synopsis, it's two paragraphs, 28, 1 to 8, with the title, The Women at the Tomb, and then the second paragraph, 28, 9 to 10, Jesus appears to the women. Now, whose turn is it to read? Let's just take them paragraph by paragraph. Wait, let me get my synopsis open. Okay, let's try 252, The Women at the Tomb. In German, the title in the synopsis is Das leere Grab. The empty grave. Okay, somebody read the Matthew. Tom, do you want to do
it? 1 to 10?
1 to 10, yeah.
Okay. Now after the Sabbath, toward the dawn of the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to see the sepulcher.
Who's the other Mary? In terms of context, it's Mary, the mother of Jesus.
Hmm. Oh, is it?
Yeah, I think so. Let's not spend time on it. I just sort of
Mark makes it mother of James.
Yeah, but I think in Matthew's check it out later. Don't we won't. But I think in terms of the context, it's an earlier listing, and I think it's Mary the mother of Jesus. Okay, go ahead.
And behold, there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone and sat upon it.
Okay, let's just go back and do it sort of verse by verse. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary, which I claim is Mary, the mother of Jesus. There are more names in Mark than in Matthew of these women. It's a slightly larger group. There are fewer names of the women in Luke than in Matthew, which is strange because Luke usually emphasizes the women, and in John, there's Mary Magdalene, who seems to be the leading Mary in this drama, but a shorter account. Then the verse you just read, that's why I wanted to slow it down and do verse by verse. Only Matthew has the great quake, and only Matthew has the bright angel who rolls away the stone. And this is kind of back to where we started with Wachin, who says that the type or the genre of Matthew is this apocalyptic myth, and that's the mode in which it is written, and clearly that's true here. This is one of four earthquakes in Matthew. Matthew's into earthquakes more than any. And then the bright angel, if we'd been working carefully with the synopsis here, you'll know that in Mark it is a young man in a white garment. In Luke it is two men standing asking the question, do you seek the living among the dead? Okay, just go on. If you read again 2 and 3, just...
And behold, there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled back the stone.
Okay, that's, you see, and came and rolled back the stone. In the sandwich, you had this preparation for this miracle. They tightened it up. They said, we're going to stop these people from stealing his body. And then, who intervenes? God intervenes. And there's an earthquake, which probably loosened the stone a little bit. And then the angel comes and finishes the job. Okay, go ahead. Verse 4.
Yeah. Verse 3.
I'm sorry.
His appearance was like lightning, and his raiment white as snow.
Okay, now that's just embroidering, painting even more dramatically the angel who in Mark is simply a young man. Okay, go ahead.
And for fear of him, the guards trembled and became like dead men.
Those are the very guards that are going to get bribed later. Okay?
But the angel said to the women...
And I just want to make the remark that comparing what you just read to both Mark and Luke, this is much more dramatic. I mean, the guards just falling down, gee whiz. You know, listen, yeah? You're about to say something.
No, no.
That's okay. Anyway, it's a much more dramatic thing. Okay, go ahead.
But the angel said to the women, do not be afraid, for I
Okay, now let's watch the drama of this. I mean, we've made the point, and we'll do that again in the summary, that from the very beginning, Matthew is giving this surprising, iconoclastic role to women. And now this razzle-dazzle angel and this most dramatic moment when actually the great underlying, what are the things that shift in an earthquake? Plates, the underlying plates are shifting. The plates of world history are shifting. And who gets the message? Like those surprising five people in the genealogy, it's these women. And the interesting thing is that who gets named in the women here?
Who's the
Mary
Magdalene.
Mary Magdalene, with all the interesting overtones of who Mary Magdalene was. You know, scholarship can't really nail down who Mary Magdalene was. Was she this converted prostitute? Tradition has that. You don't have really unassailable proof of that, but she is named, and it's not by accident that Scorsese in The Last Temptation of Christ has Jesus in his marriage fantasy marrying Mary Magdalene. It's very, very interesting sort of poetic, mythic dimension to this. Okay, let's go. Now, notice who says what to the women. Keep reading.
But the angel said to the women, do not be afraid, for I know that you seek Jesus who was crucified. He is not here, for he has risen, as he said. Come see the place
as he said. Now the prediction that gets reflected in the very enemies, they said, this guy said he was going to get back from the dead in 3 days. Now again, Matthew the writer is reminding in the words of the angel, as he said, okay.
Then go quickly and tell his disciples that he has risen from the dead, and behold, he is going before you to Galilee.
Okay, now what's the double message that the angel tells the women? back from the dead. That's the first thing. The second thing, and this is also echoing the Markan tradition. Go quickly to Galilee. Where were they when they got that? Well, they were in the someplace in the environs of Jerusalem. And so it says, get back there to Galilee. What was the Jesus movement? According to Joachim Jeremias, the Jesus movement was a Galilean lay movement. It was something up from the little people which threatened the big people in Rome. And now the Markan tradition end with more razzle-dazzle, more drama. The Matthean tradition is saying, having the angels say, leave Jerusalem, get back to Galilee. That's where he will meet you. Okay, and another dimension of the meaning is that this is the commission for the new community. The first message is placed in the hands of Mary Magdalene as the birth of the human being, which will start the whole thing over the fourth age, is placed in the hands of this little lady, Mary. Go ahead.
May I ask a question?
Yes, you may ask more than one question.
I just noticed that in Mark's Gospel, when the angel tells him to go and tell the disciples, that in Mark says, go to tell the disciples and Peter.
Yes.
And because there seems to have been a fair amount of interest in Peter in Matthew's Gospel, why did he leave it out here?
That is a marvelous question, and my answer is, I don't know. It may be, now that's the first and honest answer. Then it may be, if you start thinking Matthean thoughts, that Matthew wants to deal with the Peter, not the Peter principle, but the Peter person very precisely. Because how does Matthew deal with Peter? That's another fascinating thing. Peter comes out of the boat and goes to Jesus, and for a while does okay and sinks. And what does Jesus call him? Oligopistos, little faither. Little faither. At the same time that when in Matthew 16:16, Peter makes the confession, you are the Christ. Jesus says, you're the one on whom, you're the rock on which we'll build the church. And let's not get into whether the Petra is the confession, all that whole Lutheran thing, Catholic fight that really wasn't very interesting. But Peter is pictured, you know, we said that there was a sort of a double image of Jesus marching together as the son of Joseph and the new Israel and still the new being just in one. Well, Peter's the same thing. The broken one, the little faither, but also the rock in which the new community is going to be built. And maybe Matthew just doesn't want to get this particular drama sort of falsely mixed in with a separate drama, which is the Peter drama. This is the drama between the women, and in the first instance is the angel, and then in the second instance, and then you're going to see an interesting literary surprise, where suddenly, without any warning, they run smack into Jesus. You know, what's going on here? Go ahead. Now, that's not an answer, but
yeah.
Go ahead.
I've got a question verse 7. Lo, I have told you. Who's the I that have told you? Is that is a reminder of the word or promise of Jesus, or was that one of the Marys?
Now, wait, I'm a little confused.
That's the angel, I think. Just
verse 7.
Verse 7, the...
Mm-hmm. Start with verse 6 again in the English. He is not here, he is risen. For just kathos apen is just as he said, is in mind, that's in 6. Come see the place where...
It's a quote that starts in 5, mm-hmm. and it's the angel.
Okay, so it's the angel. The angel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you're asking, just as the angels, when the angel said that, is that your question?
No, my question was, who is the I of I have told you? Is it?
And angels. Is it answered now? It's the angel?
The angel.
Okay. Okay, let's go on then. Where were you reading?
I think verse 8. So they departed quickly from the tomb with fear and great joy and ran to tell his disciples.
Now, remember, if you're going to play the mirror games, what happened at this point in Mark? They ran. Just read the end of Mark, isn't it? Mark, the verses 8 is the chapter of... What is the last chapter of Mark? Is it 16?
And they went out and fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had come upon them.
Yeah, go ahead, the next verse.
And they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid.
Ephabuntos gar, for they were afraid. That's this, they say, how can you end a gospel with, for they were afraid? You know, so that's another dust up in the learned community. Is that the real ending of Mark, or is there a lost ending in Mark? You all learned about that in your introduction to the New Testament thing. And of course, the answer that's being given more and more now, scholarship today says, no, that was the real ending of Mark. They wanted it to be that way. And then the point of Mark is that Mark is an euangelion or a sermon. And the real ending of Mark is the Markan form of what we have in Matthew, that go to Galilee where he will meet you. And so the challenge of Mark is that in Galilee, the movement will start over again. And what they take with them is the message of Jesus. Jesus sort of resurrected into the charisma. That's not their formulation, but that's... And if in Mark Jesus is resurrected into the kerygma, just to anticipate where we're going, in Matthew Jesus is resurrected into the community. I think that's fair, but we'll look at it. Okay. Yes, ma'am.
I remember, was it in your first session or something, we were talking about, as you again pointed out, the significance of this revelation or this being shared first with a woman, and whether we can attach any significance to that, and remembering Ivor's comment that, well, the men were off mourning Jesus' death, and it's just the women that happened to be the only ones around, that those are two different interpretations.
I think they're one interpretation. I think that the women were the only ones around, and they were around as they had been. We're going to get to that paragraph very soon. They were the ones that had been... What had the women been doing? Well, let's read that right now since you brought it up. Jeff Town is our reader, 28:9-10. Let's read that one. That's paragraph 250. But then we'll come back to this. 253. Read that at 9-10. What had the women been doing? Ivor said correctly, the guys were out mourning. The women were around, but what were they around doing? Read it.
28:9-10.
Paragraph
250. And behold, Jesus met them and said, Hail! And they came up and took hold of his feet and worshipped him. Then Jesus said to them, Do not be afraid. Go and tell my brethren to go to Galilee, and there they will see me.
Oh, wait, then I'm confused.
You're looking. I think you're wanting 27:55.
That's what I want. That's what 56. I want. We have that. That's what I want. Okay. That's what I want. Thank you.
There were also many women there looking on from afar who had followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering to him.
Okay, now wait. Let's just think. Who were the... What was the logistic team? Who were taking care of a lot of the stuff in the movement? They had followed him from Galilee. They had left. The men were asked to leave their homes and so forth. doesn't tell that Jesus asked these women, but they were there. I mean, they'd come from Galilee, and Galilee to Jerusalem is a long way. And they apparently were taking care, the ministering was taking care of keeping the movement. How many people went up to Jerusalem with Jesus out of Galilee? Well, start figuring. What?
What? A whole bunch.
12 or more.
Okay, how much is a whole bunch? Yeah. Well, you had 12 or more. Jesus makes 13. You have 3 or 4 or more women. That's how much? That's 16 or 17. And perhaps more in the whole bunch. So maybe you had 20, 25 people at the very minimum going up. Who got the food? Who took care of all kinds of stuff? Is that overreading? I mean, that passage is, so I say there's two, the two are one interpretation. It's the people that were there serving that got the first announcement of the New Age.
I don't disagree with that. I mean, and that has enough power right there that it was the servants who got the thing. But I don't usually think of the men as off mourning. I think
I don't either.
I think of the men as off afraid. Yeah. The question is who had the courage.
And disoriented. I think they're just totally disoriented by the,
No, they were hiding behind locked doors.
Well,
it's part of the oriented enough to know to be scared.
Well, I mean, it would sort of sober you if the leader gets clobbered. Mm-hmm. I mean, as it sort of should have sobered Jesus when they lopped off John's head. He should have known better, right?
Why didn't it sober the woman?
They had a traditional role to play here, and they were doing it.
Now my mind really goes wild, because is there indeed the implication in that very fact, almost, that those who weren't caught up in, quote, the primacy of it all were those who really knew what or were really open and available to what was going on.
Maybe that's another insight that was always there, but we didn't see it.
Well, is this, and this may be off the point, but it seems that Matthew has a tendency to point out that God breaks into human life at unexpected times when people are just doing what they're supposed to do. You know, the disciples in the boats were pulled as they were fishing or mending their nets. Mary, was apparently just doing what a young Hebrew woman would do. Here the women are doing, fulfilling a traditional role, and yet this is where God breaks in a very unexpected way with a very unexpected message.
It's even more complex than that. When you say filling a traditional role, absolutely. To take care of the food, to take care of the logistics. But it was not the traditional role for them to leave Galilee and whatever their responsibilities.
That's not what you meant by a traditional role.
No, it was
role.
Their traditional role to prepare the spices and go to attend to the body.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm just saying a traditional role and a non-traditional role can be combined. That's what I'm saying, you combine those two. I mean, it's what is the new? The new is always a rearrangement of the old, isn't it? I didn't get a lot of cheers on that one.
That's true.
It's so always a rearrangement of the old. No, all that came to my mind was Monty Python. Now it's something completely different.
Well, an interesting thing is that you're saying, what are the men doing? Certainly the administration thinks that the men are away plotting to steal the body rather than being behind locked doors and devastating. administration thinks, my goodness, they're going to steal this body, so yeah. we better prepare against that. Nothing.
Well, did the administration really think that, or were they just saying that to, because they were afraid there might be a real resurrection, or another possibility is the sandwich we started with, just Matthew dealing with that last sentence, for this rumor has been with us to this very day. I mean, there's just a whole series of analytical questions you asked there.
I mean, the administration apparently heard Jesus saying all through the whole thing that he would rise again, but the men didn't give it a second thought. His disciples didn't give it a second thought. Didn't even think of stealing the body fit.
No, well, resurrection wasn't well practiced. I mean, they didn't have a lot of experience of people, you know.
What are we going to do with him when he comes back? Was not a question they were asking.
No, I think that's my point.
Yeah.
Well, it seems to me that the question about the women, I mean, has some high stakes in our day anyway. I mean, I think that's the reason that we're really talking about this, is that we're trying to understand what really happened and the importance of the fact that the message at the end, the message of the resurrection in all accounts, was given to women. And, you know, what does that mean? I mean, does that have, is that another clue of the new creation, of the things that are shifting around, of breaking the molds and the forms that had kept women in a certain place?
And the answer to that is clearly yes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's why I tried to start out last Monday with context. When I was at seminary, we never even noticed that it was the women. I mean, we noticed it, but it had no significance. And the significance comes in a new context. Mm-hmm. And once the question gets asked, you say, by golly, it's women. Mm-hmm. By golly.
Yeah.
And then you discover, which was always there, this sort of theme, this sort of just below the surface, little sticks of dynamite hidden throughout the Matthean account. It was almost there, but we didn't see it. And you see, when you say the stakes are high, isn't that fascinating, the way the context of the culture or the congregation will force us to see things that we never saw before? I don't know if that was just an unnecessary rephrasing of what you were saying. But.
Well, I think it matters. I mean, it matters. And my hunch is that's why Carol brought it up again. It mattered to me the other day when Ivor said that, because it seemed to me, Ivor, like you were sort of minimizing the role of women or the revelation to women. And maybe you weren't. No, that's the way I understood it, but maybe you weren't. Okay. It's good to know.
I think I was trying to play the devil's adequate.
What you're trying to say, I was playing the devil's adequate advocate. That's what you're trying to say.
But it's nonetheless, you know, in my mind, true that, you know, that the disciples had to have been just totally disoriented by this whole event and scared to death, because their lives
with
were
reason,
in
with
real
reason,
danger.
With reason,
huh?
With reason, really, they were scared to death.
I mean, there's no mystery why they are in hiding.
Yeah, but he also, the phrase he says to the women, do not be afraid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't think we have a right to assume that the women weren't also somewhat shook by all this either.
And, but they were there.
Yeah.
But they were there.
Yeah.
Their bodies were there.
Yeah. And
maybe that wasn't the danger point. Maybe that wasn't the big danger point at the grave and so forth. But they were there. They were in the action, clearly.
Well, I believe
and not to spend too much, a whole lot of time on this, but I do believe that if it were very important to God, that men were the ones, that males per se were the ones, that God would have revealed God's self to the disciples in hiding. I mean, that, you know, the resurrection would have been told somehow to them.
Oh, it was in Luke. It was in Luke.
Jesus
comes into the room. Jesus comes into the room, gets through the locked door, or isn't that it?
Yeah.
In Luke, isn't that right?
In John 2.
Walks through the door. I think it's significant that there was women, but my worry is that if we make it too significant, read too much into it, we're playing right into the hands of people who use that same argument to say, look, all the apostles were male, and so we should stay with, you know, apostolic ministry should always be males. You know, they're playing the very same game. They're looking at this and they're reading so much into that.
They're playing the either or game. Yeah. Isn't it possible to play the both and game?
Well, it is if over time both sides, so to speak, have had relatively equal say and equal power, but it has not been that way. And women have still continually over the centuries been relegated to subordinate roles culturally and within the church by the church. And so it's important, you know, again and again we have to lift up the freeing of women from those things, the very fact that very important roles were given to women that broke them out of those roles, because the church has still not heard it after 2,000 years. We're not on a level playing field. I mean, we still have to make those same, we still have to lift that up because we're still fighting the same battles. I mean, we're only now celebrating 20 years of women's ordination in the Lutheran Church. I mean, as a mark of where we aren't even and haven't been playing, you know, with equal power over the years.
Without taking one iota from what you just said, let's make it a little more complicated. Pick up the context today. Now, this is another one of my prejudicial statements, but I'm going to make it anyway. I say the only thing that keeps the Roman Catholic Church in the United States, the Roman Catholic Church that I know, going, is the nuns. Why? A lot of interesting reasons. One is that they are the ones that have chosen to be at the grassroots place. Two is that they're the only ones that haven't had mind-cauterizing theological education. They're free still to think. The women in the Roman Catholic Church are going to have ordination within the next 50 years, I'm predicting. But right now, they are, with their vitality and in their, from below coming up, bubbling, I'll have to use the vitality again, they are the ones who are really carrying the ministry of, and the vitality of the Roman Catholic Church. I'm convinced of it. That's an irony that is probably being talked about also here. That's not to take away anything from what you are saying. It comes really to sort of dramatic expression in a conversation I remember between two sisters, physical sisters, one, blood sisters, when I was on sabbatical at St. John's Abbey. One of them, a Catholic lay woman, the other, a Catholic nun. And Patty, the laywoman, who was the pastor to students in a Catholic girls' school, she was doing everything except she had to get a priest in to do the magic. And she said, I will live to be ordained. And her nun sister said, but Patty, why do you want to be ordained into these patriarchal structures? Because with your vitality, you will just perpetuate these structures. Now that's the excruciating sort of issue for a lot of feminism. These two sisters, blood sisters, one who'd chosen to be a nun, one who'd chosen to be a layperson with magnificent preaching gifts and theological gifts, and I was gunning towards ordination. I guess the issue that you have to ask, and it goes back to the question you have to ask, it goes back to the issue of where does real ministry, where does presence occur? Is it in the patriarchal structures, or is it in these other structures? Here, hit me.
We're really digressing, but I just can't get over how. I'm just sorry that you're saying that because.
Well, I'm sorry I'm saying it too, but I said it, so hit me.
All right. Well, you know, why do men who are ordained say, gosh, this isn't such a great thing anyway, why would you want to get into it?
No, wait, but I wasn't quoting a man. I was quoting a sister to
okay,
a sister.
Well, it's, but you are a man saying it.
Yes,
I mean, it's clearly to ordained men, it's a precious thing that they want to keep precious. And it's, for some men, less precious if women are ordained. And one of the, and some women also, I understand that feminist argument that it is patriarchal, it's a male kind of thing, but there is something that happens and is important in the church. It's sort of like, and I think, as I've struggled through these thoughts over the years, mm-hmm. many years thinking I'm a very adequate, important lay person. My ministry is very mm-hmm. vital and important. But there's something unexplainable, like in foot washing. There's something to it. There's something in it. There is something in ordination that goes beyond our explaining, goes beyond patriarchy. Patriarchy has not brought into existence or defined or limited ordination. There's something that happens from God in ordination, I believe. And that,
well, at least there's something that happens from God in baptism.
Well, and I don't mean.
For 25 years have said all the ordination we need is our baptism, but that's another battle.
Well, then why don't you renounce your ordination? And you know, I mean, I just when I hear men saying it's no big deal, why do you want it? But they protect it like crazy from women getting in it. I mean, there is something very important about it. There's something very important about it, and there's obviously something important to the church. I mean, you know, you can't say the magic words until you're ordained. You can't wear the stole until you're ordained. You can't say that sentence in the prayer of confession that, you know, as a called and ordained minister of the Church of Christ, I forgive you of your sins. I mean, there's a lot that you can't do if you're not ordained. There's a lot you can do if you are ordained. And there's,
and
it means something.
I'd like to jump in here. I agree with everything you've said, but I'd say you better do something different with your ordination than men have been doing with it. Because I don't see the church, the structured church, as doing a great deal for us these days and answering the problems of the present time. And the ordained people are the leaders.
I would say I would fight for ordination right now as a union card. But I don't buy myself a lot of the hocus pocus associated with it. At our seminary, we did a study about 20 years ago saying we felt that commissioning was more important than ordination. That it was an anachronistic structure that only the educated ordained could preside at the Eucharist. My feeling is that it would be much more in keeping with the New Testament and Pauline spirit of gifts if each congregation chose as the presider at the Eucharist for a period of time the elder who had the greatest respect. There's no reason why you have to have studied Greek or got a theological degree to say the words of institution, to help the community remember the night in which he was betrayed. There's no reason at all for that. No reason at all. I would like to have been led in the Eucharist all those years, as in one sense I was, by either my grandfather or my grandmother, both simple farmers, whose profound faith even our pastors sort of bowed before. I mean, I think that we're in a time when structures will have, like you said, when structures will have to change. There is no biblical reason why the educated clergy are the only ones that can do baptisms and so forth. There's no reason for that. I mean, I think the educated clergy have a role to play. I think I've learned something through the years about the scriptures that I can share with a few people. I think the educated clergy, but the magic as the sole property of the ordained clergy, men or women, is for me a Roman Catholic structure that we don't need to keep going. But that's, like you said, it is a divergent, but it's a wonderful
one. In no way would I want to demean the whole question of the ordination of women. I think that's a discussion in itself. I have problems, I think, when someone wants to tie that question of ordination of women to a specific text like this. I don't think that Matthew in writing was writing this way or the way he did in order to get the church of 1990s or the centuries before to rethink the question of ordination. I think he was sharing a witness.
He was dealing with much more fundamental issues than that.
And Easter Sunday, I am certainly not going to preach a sermon that addresses the question of ordination of women.
Nor will I.
Well, I would not assume that you would, but...
You will probably preach a sermon that addresses what the new community looks like.
Oh, sure.
And how men and women, because you can't avoid it since the age asks the question, and how men and women relate in the new community. You probably cannot avoid that.
Yeah, because even though it doesn't talk about ordination, it certainly talks about roles people play. I mean, that's part of what's going on there.
Yeah.
And one of the implications in the church is what roles the men and women have.
Yeah, I certainly don't think we ought to pretend that Mary Magdalene was a male with a funny name. I'm certainly not going to do that.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it was a male who took the name of Mary, and...
So you're saying there's nothing, you would not try to cover up the fact that...
No. We celebrate the fact that no women were there serving the risen... the risen Christ. Yeah.
Well, they were there not serving, only serving. They were carrying the message of the resurrection.
Exactly. Yeah.
The message that founds the new community. Mm-hmm. They were carrying that message. That was the first human instrumentation mm-hmm. of proclamation in the new church. Can we get back a little bit into the text, because we're not going to finish this today. But the point, the literary point is that, first of all, it's the angel that gives them the instruction. And then, as though Matthew were in this conversation with us this morning, who is the next person? I read it by mistake, but let's do that again. Who is the next person that gives the... instruction. Will you read again, Tom, verse 9? Without transition or preparation, well, you read verse 8 or 9 so we can see that it's true, that it's without transition or preparation, we come to verse 9.
Okay, verse 8. So they departed quickly from the tomb with fear and great joy and ran to tell his disciples. And behold, Jesus met them and said, Hail! And they came up and took hold of his feet.
Where did Jesus meet them? We don't know.
He isn't specifying.
doesn't specify. It's just bang, bang. We don't know whether they were halfway there or whether they were just bang. The importance is not where, but that. Okay, read it.
Hail, and they came up and took hold of his feet and worshipped him. Then Jesus said to them, do not be afraid. Go and tell my brethren to go to Galilee, and there they will see me.
What's the significance of they grabbed his feet?
It was an act of worship, as far as I understand. Anybody else with any ideas? Now, the interesting thing is, we've seen that Matthew has built on Mark. And back to the Mary Magdalene thing. In Mark, it says explicitly that he first appeared to Mary Magdalene, from whom he cast out seven demons. Remember that? So in addition to the woman dimension, you have the iconoclastic dimension that the message of the New Age comes to the least likely. To the least likely. That's in the tradition. That's one of the cluster of meanings that we talked about earlier around the name Mary Magdalene. It's not explicitly stated in Matthew as it is in Mark, but it is there in the tradition.
And what a contrast, you know, with the two whom he confronts or appears in Luke. The women immediately recognize him, the two, you know, again, it seems to be part of the disorientation of the crucifixion with them. You know, they don't even recognize him. The women immediately.
Peter, are you implying by that the nature of Matthew's account is that the women hear it first because they are the least likely ones to have received it?
Who is the master, the figure around whom the new community is built? A crucified criminal. Pretty unlikely, right? Who is the new human being? An executed insurrectionist. That's the principle, I think. The least likely. Jesus is the least likely. Is that correct?
I gotta really struggle with that one because...
Well, to make it even more difficult, in Matthew, that's back to why I say you can't really sidestep, if you're going to do Lent, the cry of dereliction. Who is the one on whom the new humanity is built? The one who was abandoned by God. The least likely. Now, is that a pattern in Matthew? Is that a pattern that Lutheran theology of the cross brings to Matthew? I think it's a pattern in Matthew.
Well, we saw it all the way through Luke, too. I mean, this is something where I can see a connection between Luke and Matthew, that in Luke's gospel, over and over, there was the pattern of Jesus reaching out and including the least likely kind of people. So it's clearly not just one evangelist. But what's helpful is thinking back to the second lecture or so, where you were talking about households and what how households typically were structured, and how this is a whole restructuring of the household. So in a sense, I'd say the way you phrased it was right, that in a sense Jesus is drawing up the least likely figures in the household to have places of at least equal prominence.
And when we talk to the about the household and going back to the housetop, the second section of it, who is put in the center? The child. Sociologically, again, the least likely. And then you have this interesting dimension also in Luke of the pais or child Christology that almost made it. Christology that you also have in the prayers of the Didache, of the least like it. So I think it's a motif that's there. Now, I thought we were going to get done early and we're just not chugging, we're chugging along slowly. I guess what I really want to say, and I think it's there, is that in you have the 1-2 punch. First the angel tells them, and then Jesus tells them, and it's the same message. He is risen from the dead. He goes before you into Galilee, and there you will see him. Now, just to summarize this section before we go into the next section. This is something I wrote, which has, I think, ramifications for our conversation now, although our conversation has been better than what I wrote. Summing up of the iconoclastic motif of the women in Matthew, you start with the genealogy of women, you know, of these five women who are unlikely bearers of the new one, the human being, with Mary being sort of the climax of that group of the unlikely. Then you move to the section we've already mentioned, the women being granted rights in the divorce section of the Haustafel, which were ultimately economic rights, very concrete economic rights. Jesus prevented divorce or raised the ante on the forbidding of divorce for the sake of protecting women's rights. In the women anointing Jesus for burial, and at the same, in the woman anointing Jesus for burial and at the same time for kingship in Matthew 26:12. The women attending him from the time of Galilee to Jerusalem, the text you reminded us of, 27:55, so forth. And then finally, the double commissioning, the double commissioning from the angel and from the risen Lord himself of the women to go to the community and to begin the proclamation of the good news. Now, I think that is there. And we've only got, well, it's 9:58. Let's do the other text and then come in for a landing. I say that when you lop this one off and don't do the commissioning thing, you're telling on Easter Sunday only half of Matthew's story. We've already talked about the other side of the sandwich, the lower crust on the apologetic about the body. But let's read now text, which I hope you will also preach on Easter Sunday morning, or let its resonating motifs be in your sermon. It's assigned, of course, for the first Sunday after Pentecost, Matthew 28:16-20. Who will read that?
Now the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountains to which Jesus had directed them.
Stop. Now, in terms of everything we worked around on with Luke's ascension, after we got to the end of the Acts account of the ascension, we decided it was probably taking place on a mountain. Here we have the mountain again, and one of the things that Wachin talks about in his looking at the whole of Matthew is that important things always happen on the sacred mountain. The Sermon on the Mount, and here again, the new age, the new community begins on the mountain. And notice again, what is not going to happen on this mountain? What is not going to happen?
And when they saw...
Wait, answer the question so I get it clear. What's not going to happen in Matthew's account? ascension. Ain't gonna be no ascension. That's why we did the mirror game with Luke. Okay, go ahead. Who's reading?
Okay. And when they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted.
I don't know why they had to add, but some doubted. Matthew has it in there. So maybe Matthew, with his reality orientation, is saying, even though I'm picturing the myth up here, the great, every word here is sort of summing up Mattean theology, still doubt is right there on the mount of the great commissioning. Go ahead.
And Jesus came and said to them, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me.
Okay, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. It sums up everything that has happened. It's the earthquakes, the Jesus being the generation of the Holy Spirit, going back to the genealogy, the beginning of the fourth age of humankind, all of that stands behind, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Okay?
Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son.
Okay, stop with the all nations. Now there we go back to the thing we introduced in Bachin at the very beginning. Jesus' death is the death of the old Israel. Jesus' mission until his death was mainly to the old Israel. Now with his death and with the cataclysmic shifting of the great plates of history and human existence, he leaves behind old Israel, and he is the firstborn of the new humanity for all nations. That's there. I think that's there. In sort of germ form, in nugget form, in that all nations. The universalism has exploded out of the death and resurrection. Yeah.
Speaking of universalism, what is the Greek word? You're reading Greek there too, aren't you, simultaneously? The Greek word for nations, what is it called?
Let me just see. That's Matthew. I wasn't, didn't have it
8:19.
Pardon me?
It's Matthew 28:19. All nations.
Matthew 28.
I'm sorry, I thought you were following.
Well, I was earlier. I should have been, but I wasn't. Oh, here it. Here it is. If I can only see. Panta ta ethna. It's ethnos. It's the same Greek word as behind Gentiles and so forth. All the nations.
All the nations, but it does mean specifically people.
Yes.
It doesn't mean
Russia and the United States.
No,
and
but France. It doesn't mean all of creation, all creatures, in other words.
No. It's, I mean,
specifically
it,
means
to my limited knowledge of Greek, it's people. It's not.
Because people like Matthew Fox have been attributing, you know, giving cosmic dimensions, and I'm just curious as to.
Well, I mean, I haven't seen it yet, but maybe Matthew Fox could instruct me, but that's where I am right now. Okay.
Was it Jesus' intent?
Pardon me?
Was it Jesus' intent from the very beginning of his ministry to go to all the earth? Or
oh, that's a very good question. That's, again, I don't know. That's the only honest answer. But I would say I believe that Matthew leaves hints in his gospel that Jesus had to learn. Remember the woman who just would not be blessed? Remember what he said, isn't it in Matthew? I haven't checked that recently, but he said, don't you know that I'm supposed to just go to the house of Israel? I think, let me get away from Matthew, just say what I think. I think that Jesus learned through his mission, he was a real human being, learned through his mission, that it had to be beyond Israel. And I think he was taught that by some of the people that came to him with their needs. I think that's behind this text we were talking about. So you have that interesting reflection of the historical Jesus over in Hebrews, where it said he learned obedience by the things he suffered. You know, you go outside of the realm of the synoptics and you get this strange thing over in this stylized high church, if you'll pardon the expression, the book of Hebrews. But there you have the vision of, or the echo or the memory of Jesus who learned his job, who learned his mission by the things he was involved in. That would be my answer to your thing. Okay, let's continue.
Baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. And lo, I am with you always to the close of the age.
Okay, now, just a couple things for summary there. We've talked about the universal call. What is the, what kind of constitutes the new community? What constitutes the new community?
Obeying the commands of
Jesus. Well, what's first?
Baptizing and teaching.
Baptizing and teaching. Now just click your mind on a little bit. Baptism, when we read this text into our context, means what? Christian baptism.
New birth. Mm-hmm.
Baptism when the people in Antioch who had, let's say now, only the Matthean scroll before them. They didn't have all, they didn't have the green hymnal, thank God. They didn't have other things. They had only the Matthew scroll in front of them. What would baptism recall for them? Jesus' baptism. And Matthew's telling of Jesus' baptism. They were baptized into Jesus' baptism. That was, even if it was here in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, their memory would be of their scrolls telling of the baptism. And what's the heart of the baptism in Matthew's telling of it? Or what's a memorable moment in that drama? You were going to ask a question.
Well, I was going to make a statement. It seems to me that we can't, it's like John's gospel. We have to assume there, that this was not the only scroll that they had.
Why do we have to assume that?
Well, why wouldn't we assume that? Why would
I wouldn't assume and, it because the four gospels had their distribution around in other places. The evidence you've got is for, you know, the four Gospels beginning to talk to each other, the manuscript tradition beginning to pick up, you know, the longer ending of Mark, because the scribes weren't satisfied with it, is something that gets dated up into the second century. I firmly believe that, you know, remember all the stuff that Raymond Brown has done on the fourth gospel, and then the community of the beloved disciple, before he sort of reconstructs the community life on the basis of the various redactions of the fourth gospel, and then the Johannine epistles. I think that that kind of reconstruction is probably reflecting what really happened, that at the beginning, maybe even to the whole first century, there were these communities that were formed and also redacted a one manuscript tradition. So that's why I said, I don't know that I would assume that in the year 85, the people in Antioch, if all this reconstruction is correct, had copies of John, Mark, and Luke. I don't think
I'm not saying that, but I'm thinking back to reading I did a long time ago on the Didache.
Uh-huh.
And it seems to me people said, some scholars say, of Syrian origin, very early, even before the final redactions of Matthew. And there you would see a very if I remember the Didache correctly, a very Christian understanding of baptism, not just this baptism of Jesus, but a fuller sacramental understanding.
Well, I mean, the Didache is like so much of the material in the early Christian tradition, many levels. I mean, and it's years since I've worked on the Didache too, but I remember being totally convinced that the Eucharistic prayers in the Didache were among the earliest, because they had this Pais, or this child Christology, which you also find embedded in certain strands of Acts. So I think the Didache has some very old material and some material that sort of just was added into it, put together into it as it came out. I'm sort of losing your point, but
my only point was that I guess I was surprised by that. By what you said about understanding baptism only from the point of Jesus' baptism.
Well, you see, I'm trying to take seriously the fact that there was probably a whole community formed by the Matthew scroll. I mean, that seems to be in the Matthew scholarship. That's what Christopher Stendahl was saying about in his book, The School of St. Matthew. And the point I'm making here is that when the first readers would come to the end of the scroll and they'd say baptism, they would think of Jesus' baptism and this interesting dramatic thing, again, unique to Matthew, for thus it is fitting that we fulfill all dikaiosyne, all righteousness. So it would evoke again the rightness, right-orderedness, justice motif that is there throughout. And then that one gets nailed down. This is my point. I don't know whether you buy it or not. And it gets nailed down by saying, teaching them to... So you have baptism and then teaching. And what is the teaching that they would think of? Luther's Small Catechism? No.
Sermon on the Mount.
Sermon on the Mount, the big parables, the mountain peaks that we're putting here, the judgment of the world, the laborers in the vineyard, the unmerciful servant, all that stuff. That's what I think it's legitimate to go right back into. That's why one of the reasons behind my plea last night that we preach on Matthew when we're preaching on Matthew. Because Matthew is a united narrative. Matthew intends, I think, at the end here to use this Great Commission as kind of a recapitulation of the main themes of his presentation of the whole story.